Ahmadiyya movement is not Islam, although the movement claims to be the true Muslims, right? The slogan is that we are the true Muslims, and the rest of the Muslim community around the world, 2 billion odd Muslims, are not upon true Islam. The first thing is that he's a prophet of God.
Right.
This is outrightly untrue. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the character of a prophet. He was...
Why do you say that?
He was narcissistic. He was abusive. He was foul-mouthed. Outrightly, he called people bastard children for disbelieving in him. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani claimed that Prophet Muhammad stated that there was a prophet in India who was black-skinned and his name was Kahin, in other words Krishna or Krishan, right? We are asking them to produce this statement. There is not a collection of hadith on the planet. In fact, he claimed to be him, the very essence of Prophet Muhammad himself. He claimed to be the Prophet Muhammad, the second advent of Muhammad. He claimed to be the second advent of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He said things like, for example, Jesus was born just as insects are born during monsoon, right? Yeah, yeah, he did say this, okay? And he made...
And he wrote this.
He wrote this categorically. So in case those who don't know Declan is an author, a researcher. He has researched the Ahmadiyya movement. He wrote a book on the Lahori movement of the Ahmadiyya sect. And Voices of Modern Islam is also one of his books. He's very interested in Islam and modern Islam. So do look into these works and do listen to the interviews Declan has conducted recently with other thinkers and intellectuals. Thank you so much, Declan.
Thank you very much.
Okay, in this interview today, we will be discussing some beliefs of the Ahmadiyya community and how they propagate those beliefs, and when they are challenged on these beliefs, some of them outrightly erroneous, how they respond to those beliefs. So it's like an objective attempt to understand the Ahmadiyya community, their beliefs and challenges to those beliefs and how they respond to those beliefs.
Hello everyone, you're very welcome to this podcast with me, Declan Henry, and Adnan Rashid, who's a London-based historian. Today we're going to discuss Mirza Ghulam Ahmad and the Ahmadiyya community. Hello, Adnan.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Fun.
So I know I've seen all your YouTube clips. You've been very busy the last year doing lots of debates with the Ahmadiyya community. How did you get involved in these debates?
First of all, thank you for having me for this interview, Declan, and this is a very important interview. We want to put out our views on the Ahmadiyya community and the movement. Mm-hmm. How we started these discussions and dialogues was a coincidence. I was at the Speaker's Corner, Hyde Park Speaker's Corner, one Sunday, almost a year ago, and I saw this Irish gentleman who happened to be from the Ahmadiyya movement. And I was told that he's preaching the Ahmadiyya religion. So I was asked to have a discussion with him, which I did. And this discussion turned into a debate.
This is Ibrahim Noonan. He's the Imam of the mosque in Galway.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. So he's a very important figure within the Jamaat.
Yeah. I've met him. I know him. Yeah.
Okay.
Very nice man.
I had a conversation with him. It started as a friendly conversation. Then it turned into a debate for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So we had a 2 hours debate, which went viral on social media. You know, this is a social media, the age of social media. Mm. It went on Twitter, TikTok, on Facebook, on YouTube. People started posting it. And before we know, it was a global phenomenon. For some reason, people were hungry for this content, in the English language in particular. And then we had a follow-up conversation for almost an hour. And that was also recorded and it went out. So that started the process of this dialogue, debates and exchanges, which continues to this day, after a year, nearly a year now. Yeah.
But as a historian, did you know much about the Ahmadiyya community before you started these debates?
I had basic knowledge that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani was a claimant to prophethood. And I knew basic failed prophecies he had made. I had knowledge of that. I had knowledge of his abuse that he had used against people. So I raised these questions with Ibrahim Noonan, and we had very interesting conversations.
So that, so from that first debate in Speaker's Corner, that stimulated your appetite to delve more into this?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I had to, because for the next year, we would debate Ahmadis almost on a weekly basis, right? Mm. So we had to read up on Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani more extensively. Then another individual came along, Muhammad Imtiaz, you might be aware of him. He got in touch with me. He had already completed his master's degree on the Ahmadiyya movement. He had read extensively. He had pretty much read most of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani's books. So I realized that he has very good knowledge of the movement. So we got him involved in our dialogues as well. And since then, he's been very busy as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So from the debates that I've seen, Adnan, you know, you seem to have put across many interesting scholarly arguments. So what sort of a response have you actually got from the Ahmadiyya community themselves?
We never get a straight answer.
Okay.
The murabbis or the missionaries of the movement have devised strategies and tactics to avoid direct, difficult questions. We pose direct questions, but we never get a direct answer. Anyone who watches our streams with them, in the English language, I'm talking about the missionaries, I'm not talking about the common Ahmadis. Common Ahmadis are normal working class people. They are going about their business. They are educated people, many of them doctors, engineers, highly qualified.
Yeah, I know many of them,
persons,
yes.
And they are decent people.
They are very nice people.
But the trained missionaries,
they're a different kettle of
fish. They are absolutely different breed altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are very manipulative. We have found them to be very manipulative. They don't give direct answers. And when they get cornered, they avoid debate altogether. They completely disappear.
I'm surprised. Well, on one level, I'm surprised because, I mean, one of the criticisms that they have always put across, the Ahmadiyyas that I've spoken to, is, you know, the lack of dialogue. This is before you started and before the debates online have started. The lack of dialogue, that they always said, oh, Sunnis don't want to debate us. Sunnis don't want to talk to us. Well, this is the ideal opportunity now that there are so many debates and they're lively debates. They're incredibly interesting. And you are touching upon those questions that really need to be asked, but also need to be answered.
Absolutely. You see, Jacqueline, social media phenomenon has changed the dynamics for the Ahmadiyya movement. Now they cannot simply ignore and get away with it.
No. 30 years ago, yes, before the internet.
Absolutely. For the last 100 years, they have been making these claims that the Sunnis cannot debate us. They don't want to debate us. They run away from debates, which is a lie, by the way. Our scholars for the last 100 years from all denominations of Sunni Islam have been actively debating and having dialogues with the Ahmadiyya community. They have written books upon books. Encyclopedias have been produced by Sunni scholars in the Urdu language, mainly because the cult came from, I call it a cult, because it operates like a cult. That's my personal opinion. Okay. It was born in India, then flourished in Pakistan later on. And this is why the Indian subcontinent scholars feel more responsibility towards producing works on this particular movement, and they have done so. But the claim that Sunnis are avoiding the discussion and the dialogue has been now binned since the last 1 year activism on our part, because we have now opened the gates of dialogue for the Ahmadiyya community. We have streams every single Saturday. Since the last year, we have had live streams where the floor is open to the Ahmadiyya scholars, if they have any.
I'm glad that you've said that, because I was going to ask you, who exactly are the top scholars within the Ahmadiyya community?
They don't have scholars.
They don't have scholars.
They don't have scholars. They have some Arabic-speaking gentlemen who appear to be scholars, who have the attire, who wear the clothing of scholars, but when we dialogue with them, we realize they lack basic knowledge of Islamic principles. So if they are scholars...
And are they based here in the UK or in Pakistan?
They are based in the UK. Some of them are based in the Arab world. For example, they have one person in Jordan. There is a Palestinian person who speaks Arabic. So they parade them around the world as trophies. We have Arabs with us. If we have Arabs with us, we have some credibility, because the Arabs know Arabic, the Arabic language. Therefore, they must know more Islam than normal Sunni Muslims, which is, again, a deceptive tactic on their part. Okay, if you ask these Arab scholars, whether if they know the Urdu language. They don't. They haven't read Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani in the Urdu language. And majority of his works are in the Urdu language.
Course, yeah,
so
yeah,
how
yeah,
can you claim yeah. to be a scholar on your yeah. own movement when you don't know the basic language? It's like me claiming to be a scholar of Islam and I don't know the Arabic language. Would you take me seriously?
No, that would be difficult.
Yes.
That would be difficult.
It's like someone who claims to be a scholar of Christianity and doesn't know Koine Greek and doesn't know Latin, or someone, a Jewish rabbi, claims to be a rabbi and doesn't know the Hebrew language. Mm-hmm. So this is why we are yet to find a scholarly person among the Ahmadiyya movement. I'm not, and this is not an exaggeration, this is not a biased statement. I'm being very fair and objective here. I'm yet to find a scholar of Islam among the Ahmadis.
No, that was the reason that I asked you, because I just didn't know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And obviously, Ibrahim Noonan, you know, he, I don't know whether he speaks Urdu or not.
No,
I don't
he doesn't.
Think he does. I didn't think he would.
In my dialogue, I challenged him on this question, and he didn't know Urdu.
And he's a convert to Islam himself, yes.
Yeah.
And Raziullah Noman, obviously you did quite a lot of debate with Razi.
He's a missionary.
He's a missionary, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wouldn't come into the what you'd call top scholar.
No, he's a young man. He's very passionate. He's a missionary.
Certainly is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So they have missionaries.
Yeah.
They have seminaries where they train missionaries to respond to the Sunni attacks, intellectual attacks or theological attacks.
Would somebody like Razi, would he not have read all of the works of Mirza Ghulam?
He claims to have read all of them.
Really?
And I believe him. I don't have any reasons to not believe his claim.
Now, you've read some of them yourself, because
yes.
obviously you're fluent in Urdu and you're a highly literate man. From the debate, we can see that you're ferociously intelligent.
If you think so, I don't necessarily agree with that.
Well, you have great panache. You're very articulate. Your knowledge flows. But one of the things that I see that you're continuously accused of is not being able to differentiate between what's metaphorical and literal in the writings of Mirza Ghulam.
Is that
not a little bit insulting to you?
It is. It is. It's insulting my intelligence. It's insulting.
I thought it would.
My credentials, which is not a problem. I don't mind. But when the Qadiani or the Ahmadi Murabbis,
you could be forgiven one mistake, but they can't. It can't be continuous.
I have made mistakes.
Yeah.
I have made mistakes, and I have admitted those mistakes publicly.
Okay. Well, that's good.
For example, very often I mix two of the sons of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani because they have the same name.
They're very similar names.
Okay.
Yes,
Bashiruddin Mahmud and Bashir Ahmad.
Yes.
Right? You can see they have the same name, right?
Yeah,
so
very
I very often mix them.
Yeah.
But that's my bad, right? I've always admitted to that problem.
That's only a small mistake.
Exactly.
Small mistake.
But when I make a claim, I ensure that I'm making a claim which is evidenced. There is evidence for it. And I'm not just making up. Because at the end of the day, why am I doing this this work? I'm doing this work to reach out to the Ahmadi community, the common Ahmadis, for them to realize that this was a mistake. This was a digression. This was a diversion from mainstream Islam. This is not Islam.
Mm-hmm.
The Ahmadiyya movement is not Islam. Although the movement claims to be the true Muslims, right? The slogan is that we are the true Muslims and the rest of the Muslim community around the world, 2 billion odd Muslims, are not upon true Islam. Okay? In fact, we can show from the books of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani and his son, Bashiruddin Mahmud, where they made blanket excommunication of the entire Muslim community. When I say the entire Muslim community, I mean from Morocco to Indonesia. All Muslims are effectively disbelievers because they have rejected a true prophet of God, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
If there is a true prophet of God and if you reject him, you are disbelieving in that prophet.
Mm.
And therefore you're a disbeliever to the followers of that prophet. So, effectively, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani and his son made takfir, we use the word takfir for excommunication, they made takfir of the entire Muslim ummah.
I've read that, yes, when I was researching the Lahori book.
They deny it today. They say, no, we don't actually believe you are disbelievers in the true sense of the word, but you are disbelievers in a lesser sense. Basically, you are not true Muslims. You reject the Messiah, the promised Messiah. You reject a true prophet of God, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani, to them. Therefore, you are not true believers. But we know this is dissimulation. We know this is dissimulation. This is hiding their true beliefs. Because recently I had a dialogue online, it's on my channel, where I posed this question directly to the Murabbis, including Raziullah Noman, and they made it clear that we consider you to be disbelievers. You are disbelievers.
So that was a contradiction.
Yes. I mean, the Jamaat, official Jamaat position is that, no, you are not true Muslims. We don't call you disbelievers in the true sense of the word. But the Murabbis, the missionaries, when they were cornered, they actually came out with it and they said, yes, we do consider you to be disbelievers, just like the Lahori movement.
It's a bit
just
confusing, like, isn't it?
It is. I mean, not only us, even the Lahori movement.
Am I a believer? Aren't I a believer?
Yeah. But they declare the Lahori movement, the mainstream Qadiani caliphate based in London, this particular movement declares the Lahori movement to be a disbelieving movement. There is another group called Sachprast group. They are also disbelievers. There's a Jamba group, which is also basically a bunch of disbelievers. So they make blanket excommunication of all people who do not agree with them.
So really, if you were to believe all of that, there are very few Muslims in the world, by their reckoning?
Correct. Yes. By their reckoning, yes. By their standards, there are very few Muslims in the world. Yeah. Majority of the Muslims are not true Muslims or disbelievers.
Yeah.
Wow. Which is very radical. It's a very radical view. Yeah.
So you intend to do more debates?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't think these debates will stop in the English language in particular, because I believe the cream of the crop of the Qadiani movement is in the West.
There's still a mountain of questions to ask, isn't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel it's like peeling an onion. Once you peel one layer, another layer is there waiting to be peeled.
100%. Yeah. And the more we discover, the more shocked we are that these are the kind of things that can be found in the books of Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani, and how can a common Ahmadi, having read these things, believe in this man as a prophet? But
no,
they don't.
I'm going to come on to that in just a moment.
Yeah.
But first of all, Adnan, can we just look a little closer at the life of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad? I'm going to take advantage of you as a historian. What things do you think that the Ahmadiyya community state about him that are inaccurate or outright untrue? Can you think of anything at the top of your mind?
The first thing is that he's a prophet of God.
Right.
This is outrightly untrue. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the character of a prophet. He was...
Why do you say that?
He was narcissistic. He was abusive. He was foul-mouthed, outrightly. He called people bastard children for disbelieving in him.
And you have evidence of all of this?
100%. Everything 100%. Will be evidenced on the screen.
Will it?
We will put the quotes up. And the Qadiani movement is aware of these quotes. We have debated them for the last year. And they come back and say that the word bastard here doesn't actually mean what you think it means. It means mischievous. It means... But I my point is the word itself is highly offensive. In the Urdu language, the word is harami. I don't know if you know the Urdu language. It's a very unfortunately, I have to use this word for the sake of clarity. The word harami is a very derogatory term. It's basically an insulting word. If you say this word to anyone in Pakistan, India, or Bangladesh, you're looking for a fight, because it's a very offensive term. But they claim that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani used this word in a different sense. But then again, the problem is he didn't use just one word. He used similar words in different languages. Harami in Urdu, Haramzada in Persian, which means the same thing, a bastard child. Dhurriyatul Baghaya in the Arabic language, which means a bastard child. Okay.
Why did he resort to using this type of language?
He was an abusive man. He used this language to basically express his anger and frustration at people who were simply not believing in him or rejected him. For example, he had a debate with a Christian missionary called Abdullah Atam.
I've heard of
him. And he lost this debate. He lost this debate, and due to this loss...
Do you know why did he lose it? How did he lose it?
Well, first of all, he wouldn't debate in person. He wouldn't debate talking to the opponent, to the interlocutor.
Yeah, I did read that, and when I wrote my book, that was my mistake, because I thought that he was actually a very good public speaker, and that these were actually face-to-face
Not
debates.
Not at all.
It was later that I learned that these were written debates.
Exactly, and he insisted on having written debates because he lacked confidence in his own ability to have face-to-face debates. Like, for example, if you look at our Speaker's Corner debates, right, we have on-the-spot debates, very difficult debates at times. We debate with atheists, we debate with Christian missionaries, we debate with Jewish rabbis at times, we debate with Ahmadiyya missionaries. So you have to debate on the spot, and you don't know what's
it's
coming.
It's live, it's spontaneous.
Exactly.
Anything can happen.
Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani lacked that acumen. And he himself actually wrote that it is not for a transvestite to have manly debates like men in public. He wrote it himself, and for some reason he indicts himself by making this statement. He used the word mukhannas. Mukhannas means a transvestite, someone who lacks male characteristics. So he's saying that only a man can have public debates, but he never had one. He never had one. He insisted on having written debates, and even with this Christian missionary, he lost the debate.
Am I correct in saying that he only ever had one debate with this
gentleman?
Yes,
correct. Yeah, correct. Okay. And he lost the debate. Yes. How we know that is because he lost his own followers. People who were with him when the debate started left him and became Christians. Okay? And when he was questioned by his own followers about this loss, he came up with something very strange, and an outright lie, for that matter. He claimed that this is not something new. Prophets always lose followers due to such events. For example, he gives an example, and which is a lie, and he attributes this example to a very famous Muslim author called Ibn Kathir, who lived in the 14th century CE, who wrote one of the greatest commentaries on the Quran. He attributes this lie to him, stating that Ibn Kathir wrote that when the Treaty of Hudaybiyah took place between the Prophet and his tribe Quraysh, because they didn't allow him to enter Mecca that year. He said when the Prophet was not allowed to enter Mecca in that year, many of his truthful followers, I'm using the exact words, many of his truthful followers left him. They left Islam, which is an outright lie.
What sort of numbers are we talking about here?
He said many.
Many, okay.
He said many. And we cannot find trace of one. We cannot find any trace of any follower leaving Islam at that point. No, we cannot find one. Okay? Mm. But he said many. The point is he said many. More than one. Okay? Mm-hmm. Right? But that statement is not to be found in Ibn Kathir. He mentioned Ibn Kathir by name, and this he said to his son-in-law, who was a Nawab, who was a prince. His daughter Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani was married to one of the rulers of the princely state. He wrote this letter to his son-in-law, trying to convince him that this is not a new thing. This is not a big deal if I lost followers because of this debate. And he lied. He lied. And we asked the Jamaat, the missionaries, can you produce that reference? Can you show us where Ibn Kathir actually wrote that? Because Ibn Kathir is well known, is published throughout the Muslim world. We have manuscripts upon manuscripts. We have printed copies in millions.
And they handed it over?
Yes.
They did? Okay.
Who handed it? Sorry.
The Ahmadiyyas. When you asked them for that?
No, they did not. This is the point. They cannot produce it. It doesn't exist.
Okay.
That reference does not exist. Ibn Kathir never said any such thing. It doesn't exist. So
and
therefore,
how many times did you ask them for that evidence?
Almost every time we ask them, and they don't have an answer. They simply don't have an answer. They play games. They try to explain it away. Oh no, this might have happened. That might have happened. He didn't actually mean his. But what? Who does he mean? Many truthful ones among his followers.
If he wrote it, let you decide what he said.
Yeah.
They need to show it to you, don't they?
No, and we have given them 1 year, more than 1 year, to produce all these references. And there are many other examples, for example. For example, he claimed that Prophet Muhammad had talked about Krishna, the Hindu deity in India,
right, okay.
That he was a prophet of God. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani claimed that Prophet Muhammad stated that there was a prophet in India who was black-skinned and his name was Kahin. In other words, Krishna or Krishan, right? We are asking them to produce this statement. There is not a collection of hadith on the planet where we have documented or recorded Prophet's tradition and his sayings. We cannot find any report that shows us that. Another claim Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani made about the Prophet of Islam was that when there's a plague, you leave the town. Mirza, in his review of religion, there is a source called Review of Religion. It's an Ahmadi source. And they quote Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani saying that when there's a plague, Prophet Muhammad said, when there's a plague, leave the town. But we find the reality is completely opposite. We find the Prophet Muhammad saying in an authentic report that is reported from him that when there is a plague, do not leave your towns. And if you are outside of the town, do not come into the town.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it? Otherwise, you don't want to spread the plague.
Exactly. Exactly. So the Prophet Muhammad categorically stated that when there is a plague, do not leave the town. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani attributed the exact opposite of that.
What was his rationale for giving that advice?
To appease the British government at the time, because there was a plague in India and the government wanted people to leave the towns to go to certain settlements to stay in. And he made up this report to appease the government, to basically convince his followers that you can leave the town and go to another place to settle there. And he did that for the British government.
Wow.
To support the government policy at the time in the Punjab region, right? So this is why Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani came up with this hadith. We have been asking them for the last year, where is this report? Where did the Prophet actually say, when there's a plague, leave the town? Just like Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani attributed this report to the Prophet of Islam. What we find is to the contrary. The Prophet said, do not leave the town. Or if you are outside, do not go into the town.
Well, that makes such common sense, isn't it?
And there are, Declan, there are tons of other examples that we can give, but we do not have time for.
No, I appreciate
every
that.
Single example.
You've given me a few today, and I expected a few. But there would be literally hundreds of them.
I haven't counted, but there are tons upon tons of examples where he attributed information to the Prophet of Islam, and we cannot find that information in our books or in the books of hadith. Another report he attributed to the Prophet is that the worst scholars will be from the 14th century, or the 14th century scholars will basically disown the Messiah. They'll disbelieve in the Messiah. We're asking them to produce the report. Mm-hmm. Where's the report? Okay. If you're using a claim against the Muslims, the larger body of the Muslim community, you have to substantiate your claims. Where did the Prophet say that the 14th century scholars will disown the Messiah when he comes? Is not to be found.
I'm surprised at that, because one of the things that I find with the Ahmadiyya community, and particularly even looking with some of these debates, they're very hot on evidence, and they like people to give them evidence, but you're saying today, you're turning the tables, you're saying that you're asking them for various pieces of evidence, and they're not producing them.
You see, what they do is, one of the tactics they have mastered is the fallacy of whataboutism. Okay, when you ask them about Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani and his shenanigans or his controversial statements in his books, they present 10 different books to you from the wide ranging literature of Islam or the Sunni Muslims, for example. And we have colorful literature. Our scholars in the last 1,400 years have produced hundreds of thousands of volumes on philosophy, poetry, mysticism, Sufism, and commentaries on the Quran, commentaries on the Hadith of the Prophet, and books on history. What they do is they will pick up statements that are outrightly erroneous from the literature of Sunni Muslims or maybe some Sufi mystics, for example, who are describing their mystical experiences and their spiritual, experiments, who are describing, and these things are personal, They are not binding upon the Muslim community. They will present those things to defend Mirza Ghulam and Qadiani. That look at these shenanigans. Oh, you think there are shenanigans in Mirza's books? There are mistakes. There are errors. There are outright absurdities in his books. So
you think that's used as deflection?
100%. This is a tactic they have used for far too long, and now we are telling them, look, if you are Muslims, you claim to be Muslims, then the Quran must be your place to go. To substantiate any belief you hold, you must go to the Quran. If Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani makes a statement, you must be able to substantiate that statement from the Quran or from the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, because he claimed to be one of his followers, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, he claimed to be him, the very essence of Prophet Muhammad himself. He claimed to be the Prophet Muhammad, the second advent of Muhammad. He claimed to be the second advent of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So, he claimed many things, by the way. This is another topic we can discuss later on. What was he? What was he? What was Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani?
Well, it seems to me he was a lot of things.
He was a lot of things. Yeah. He claimed to be Prophet Muhammad, the second advent.
Yeah.
He came up with a belief.
I'd hold on for that just a moment, because I'm going to come on to the Prophet Muhammad in just a moment. But as a Christian, one of the things that I did want to ask you, and obviously I think it's mentioned in one of your debates, you know, he's alleged to have said really some highly insulting and derogatory things about Jesus and Mother Mary. Can you give me some examples of these? And I know there's in one of your debates you were limited because you said he used very vile and very foul language, and I'm not asking you to use any of that here today. But can you roughly, as a Christian, and obviously, you know, I think there's 2.4 billion Christians in the world. Most any Christian I ask about Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, they will have never heard of him.
Yes.
I don't think he has made any impact on the Christian world, even though he claimed to be the promised Messiah for all humanity. You know, very few have heard about him.
Well, he came to defeat the cross.
Yes.
That's the claim he made, and that's the claim he used from the tradition of the Prophet, because he claimed to be the second coming of Jesus too.
Did he think that was licensed to actually say, you know, really derogatory things about Jesus?
He actually did say a lot of derogatory and insulting things about Jesus Christ. He actually insulted Jesus Christ throughout his literature, which is blasphemy to Muslims, by the way.
Why? Yeah, no, okay. No, I know this.
For Muslims,
of all the Muslims I've met in my life, I've never, ever, ever, you know, encountered a Muslim that has said a bad word about Jesus.
And even when we debate Christians and use accusative answers, for example, we use passages from the Bible to show them how erroneous their beliefs are, for example, the divinity of Jesus Christ. When we use examples, we are very respectful about Jesus Christ. We don't insult him. We don't degrade his character. We don't say things that can be insulting. Yeah. But he, if we talk about Jesus, first starting with Jesus Christ himself, before we get to Mary.
Yes, okay. Please do. Please tell me.
He said things like, for example, Jesus was born just as insects are born during monsoon, right? Yeah,
really?
Yeah. He did say this, okay? And he made...
And he wrote this.
He wrote this categorically. You might be seeing it on the screen right now, okay? He said, Jesus was born just as insects are born during the monsoon season, okay? So his birth was nothing incredible. He also said that his birth was nothing incredible, okay? Because he denied the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. He denied it, okay? This is a belief the Christians and the Muslims both share.
Mm-hmm.
This is a common belief of the Christians and the Muslims,
okay?
This is stated clearly in the New Testament, and it is stated in the Quran also that Jesus was born of Virgin Mary. Mary was virgin when she conceived Jesus Christ by a miracle. This was a miracle of God. And this is how God wanted to establish the importance of Jesus Christ as an incredible personality, because his birth started with a miracle. Okay, then he spoke from the cradle. The Quran has verses in chapter 5, okay, of the Quran, where Jesus spoke from the cradle. Okay, and also, sorry, chapter 19, where the story of Mary is told in the Quran, that he spoke from the cradle. Okay. So Quran and the prophetic tradition of Islam, it honors Jesus and his mother beyond any Arab personalities. Okay, Prophet Muhammad was an Arab. Okay, and he came from a very staunch Arab background. Okay, for him to be praising an Israelite and his mother. Mm. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, because when I was doing research for my first book, I did read somewhere that the Prophet Muhammad, of all the prophets, he felt closest to Jesus.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And he even stated that we, the prophets of God, are all brothers. Okay, and do not raise the rank of one at the expense of the other. Right. So we do not make any difference. This is a verse in the Quran. We do not differentiate between prophets of God. Mm. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani, on the other hand, he stated, like I mentioned earlier, that Jesus was born just as insects are born during the monsoon. Okay, without any biological wonders happening necessarily. That's what he stated. Number two.
Why would he have said something like that?
He wanted to deny the virgin birth of Jesus Christ. He was a naturalist. Okay. He was a naturalist and he didn't believe in the supernatural. Okay. And why he was a naturalist is also a very interesting topic. In the 19th century in India, there was a naturalist movement going on. Which was initiated by a man called Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan, and Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani was influenced by that movement, and that's why he expressed some of these views. But why he insulted Jesus in this way was because he claimed to be the second coming of Jesus Christ. Prophet Muhammad had foretold in authentic reports that I take an oath in the name of Allah, in the name of God, who has my life in his possession, that Jesus Christ will return before the end times. So this is eschatology. This is Islamic eschatology. Just like the Christians believe that Jesus Christ will return, Muslims also believe that Jesus Christ will return in person. Mm-hmm. Okay, physically he will come back. We believe he wasn't crucified, he wasn't put on the cross, and he wasn't killed. Okay, he was saved against his enemies. God saved him. He prayed to God, he was saved, and he was raised alive to the heavens as a
age
miracle.
Age 33.
I mean, we don't have the age, we don't have the number, okay?
But around that age.
Around that age, in his 30s. He was a young man.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if the Hadith literature actually documents his age. I may be wrong. Okay?
But his life on earth ended then.
Yes, his life on his ministry to the Israelites, and because he was sent to the Israelites. The Quran makes a categorical statement that Jesus Christ was sent to the Israelites, and that was his prophetic ministry. He did his job, and he was raised alive, to be kept alive until he returns. And he wasn't killed, he didn't die. So we believe right now Jesus Christ is with God, alive. Okay, how, where, in what conditions, we don't know. God is perfectly capable of keeping him in a comfortable position, wherever he wants to keep him, right? And he will be sent back to do a specific job, which is to basically break the cross. Literally, break the cross means he will challenge Christians and show them the true belief, which he preached himself when he was on earth. And he will tell them that they have been wrong all the way, believing that he died on the cross, believing that he was God Almighty. He was one of the persons from the Trinity. He will come back to do that. Okay, and then he will kill swine. Okay, and he will basically lift jizya. Basically, this will be the final showdown. This is Armageddon, basically, right? And he will kill Antichrist, Dajjal. Mm-hmm. We know him as Dajjal, the Antichrist, who will come near the end of times, and he will be a great trial for humanity, and Jesus Christ will specifically come back to kill him. Okay, this is why he's coming back, not as a prophet to the Israelites again, because he had already done his prophetic capacity. Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani claimed to be that second coming. And in order to do that, he had to kill Jesus Christ. First, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani claimed that Jesus was crucified. He was actually put on the cross, nailed to the cross,
and survived.
Yeah. That's one thing. Second thing, he mentioned that after he survived, he traveled towards India and he died in Kashmir and got buried in Kashmir in Srinagar.
Aged 120.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Where he got this?
And this is very, 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 very hard. Good luck to the person that wants to debate them on this. This is very hard to prove the Kashmir part to it, because he stated as a divine revelation from God.
Yeah.
How do you prove that?
Exactly. And he's the only person in humanity who leads a movement like this, who came up with this idea. Okay, and on top of that,
I'm glad that you mentioned that point, because I was going to ask you that. Anybody else has tried to rearrange?
So there was a Jewish journalist who had written this theory before Mirza claimed this incredible thing about Jesus Christ and his life, and for some reason he also claimed that Jesus had come to India and died in India, and Mirza Ghulam Qadiani took that idea possibly from him. But there is this precedent, the only precedent we can find of this theory in human history. Okay, so it seems that Mirza Ghulam Qadiani was borrowing ideas from a number of different sources. He took stuff from the Sufis, he took some stuff from the Christians, he took stuff from some Islamic thinkers in the 19th century and adopted those ideas and made up his own religion in his Ruhani Khazain or in his books, for that matter. Okay.
But did he, going back to Jesus, do you think that he saw some weakness in Jesus?
Yes, he did. He had to find a weakness in Jesus. Why? Because, look, it is but natural for people to demand miracles, because the first coming of Jesus Christ was packed with miracles, incredible events. Jesus, did amazing, wonderful miracles in the New Testament, according to the New Testament and the Quran. The Quran attributes some very powerful miracles to Jesus Christ. For example, he made birds of clay and blew life into them with the permission of God. Right? He basically healed blind and lepers, okay, by the permission of God. He did all these miracles according to the New Testament and the Quran. So people naturally demanded miracles from Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani. Okay, you are the second coming of Jesus Christ. You are the promised Messiah as foretold by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Now that Jesus Christ has died and buried in Kashmir, you are that second coming. Can you show us miracles? And how did he respond? Well, those miracles that you attribute to Jesus Christ were not actually miracles. That was mesmerism. That was mesmerism. And again, I'm not making these claims. Just because I like to make these claims, the evidence is on the screen. You can see where he categorically stated that these miracles of Jesus Christ were amletirb. He called it amletirb, basically in the English language, mesmerism. This was not basically miracles. These were tricks that Jesus performed and people thought these were miracles. So Jesus was a trickster. And this is what Mirza Ghulam Qadiani, to get away from performing miracles or to actually substantiate the spiritual power of his ministry.
Undermine Jesus in every way possible.
100%. That was the idea. The idea was to undermine Jesus Christ, to inflate his own character, so that people actually believe his claim to be the second coming of Jesus Christ. This is why he's called the promised Messiah. Which promised Messiah is the question? Jesus Christ. By the way, the term promised Messiah is not an Islamic term. It's actually a Jewish term that he used to claim for himself. Okay, in Islam, we simply have this this concept, the second coming of Jesus. We have this concept, the second coming of Jesus. We don't call him the promised Messiah. Okay, Masih Mawrud, the term they use for Mirza Ghulam Qadiani, is not even an Islamic term. It's not used in the literature of Islam anywhere, right? Masih Mawrud, or the promised Messiah. It's a Jewish term that Mirza Ghulam Qadiani decided to use for himself. And he meant Jesus Christ, the second coming of Jesus Christ. So that's why he had to belittle Jesus Christ, deny his miracles, okay? Put him on the cross and kill him in Kashmir. And amazingly, this is something you have to know. His magnus opum, as they say, okay, magnum opus, the work he produced, and he was proud of, called Barahine Ahmadiyya.
His
five volume, which was supposed to be 50 volumes. He had promised to produce 50 volumes of this book, or 50 parts of this book, and he took money from the Muslims to publish that book. The book was never completed, it was never produced, and the money was never returned, although the Jamaat claims that the money was returned. And amazingly, Declan, he wrote categorically, the book is complete. I have written the entire book, It has powerful 300 arguments in favor of Islam. It has powerful 300 arguments in favor of Islam. The book is complete. I have already finished the book. In 1879, this claim was made. Okay. Now I need money to publish the book. Can you, the Muslims, give me money so that I can publish the book? We did an entire stream on this, by the way. It's on our channel. And then the book was never produced. He was given money, tens of thousands of rupees. Muslims from all over India sent him money to produce the book, because by this time he hasn't claimed to be anything like a prophet of God or the promised Messiah. He's still in the early stages of his claims and ministry. So his reality is not actually known to people. People think he's a prolific author who is going to produce this great work to defend the beliefs of Islam and the arguments of Islam. So he has promised to produce this book, which is already written, mm-hmm. right? And then the money is received in tens of thousands of rupees, which is a lot of money in the Indian subcontinent.
Did they expect it to be in 50 parts?
Yes, right. Exactly. Okay. Why were the people sending money? Because they want to see these 300 arguments
right.
in favor of Islam.
So, but he says he got the 300 arguments into 5 volumes.
No, he didn't say that. He never claimed the book. He claimed the only difference between 50 and 5 is a zero. That's what he said. and again, I'm not making this up. Right. This is all there. It's all recorded.
It was a clever answer.
Yeah, it was a very clever answer. To get away with, to keep the money and to get... So, his ministry started with a fraud, with deception, with daylight robbery.
Well, what he did produce.
He produced only 5 parts.
This was one of the questions I was going to ask you. Yes. Was it really highly intellectual?
No, it wasn't, unfortunately. Okay. It was borrowed information. And all the good stuff he had written in this book was borrowed from other sources, Islamic sources. It was all borrowed and plagiarized.
Okay. Oh,
so the credit doesn't actually go to Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani himself, but to those authors who had written this information before him. So whatever good stuff he has written in this book, and there is good stuff in the book, he has written it having borrowed from other sources before him, right? But whatever stuff that came from his own mind is basically below, you know, decent level or substandard. It's substandard stuff, okay? And the Jamaat claims to be... Jamaat claims for him to be the king of the pen. Okay? Sultanul Kalim or Sultanul Qalam. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or the king of the words.
I want to ask you a little bit about his works in just a moment. But just to finish...
But I want to come back to Jesus.
Why did he attack Mother Mary?
Okay, we're going to come back to Mary. But let me give you some other examples of what he actually
said
called
about
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
He called him a drunkard.
He did, yes. Yeah. So that in one of your...
He called him a drunkard, and this was his personal belief. The Jamaat comes back and claims, no, this was accusative answer. He was using biblical text to get back at the Christians. And we claim...
Well, where does it say in the New Testament that Jesus was a drunkard?
Exactly. Where does it say that he was drinking?
I found that extraordinary that they think that the New Testament is anti-Jesus, so that it would contain these references that would be highly derogatory to Jesus.
Absolutely. But this
was
his
understanding. The New Testament is pro-Jesus.
Exactly. It wants to present Jesus as some divine being.
Well, you're not going to find it in the New Testament. You're not going to find derogatory things in the New Testament.
Exactly. And this was his personal belief, his personal conviction that Jesus was a drunkard and he had relationships with prostitutes. And the Jamaat gets very disturbed by these...
Is that quotes. Twist in something about Mary Magdalene?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. And he also wrote that what was wrong with him, that he was getting his head massaged by... a prostitute who had bought that oil from her earnings, her illegitimate earnings. So he said these things in very, very strong words. Okay, and he claimed to have written this stuff as accusative answer. But then he broke his own principles. He put down a principle in his writings that you cannot use such vulgar and evil language for a beloved of God or a prophet of God, even in accusative answer. You cannot use such language, but he did himself. He broke his own principle that he put down in his works, that you cannot use such language even when you feel like throwing back at your opponents and throw something like, something disturbing as this. back at them. You cannot do it because we love Jesus Christ. That's what he claimed. But then he contradicts himself directly using terms like this. He also claimed that Jesus Christ, because of his birth, abnormal birth, whatever it was, okay, he lacked male organs. He lacked male organs. Yes. This is what he wrote. These are the details that are not known to the common Ahmadi. They don't know these things that he actually wrote about this Jesus Christ. And this is not to be found in the New Testament. Let's, for the sake of the argument...
I've never heard that before in my life.
Well, he wrote this. He wrote this, and he claimed that he lacked, because of the defect in his birth...
Well, where did he get this information from?
It was coming from his own mind.
Yes.
Okay, it was his perverted mind, and he was completely making this up, okay, in his own mind. And if the Jamaat claims this was accusative answer, show us where the New Testament or any of the apocryphal Christian literature states that Jesus lacked male abilities or male hormones or male organs.
They won't find that.
It is not there. Jesus was a man.
Yeah.
He was a man. We know him as a man, right? So these are the kind of insulting things he wrote about Jesus Christ, that he was a drunkard, he was a man of loose character. The reason why God did not call him Husur in the Quran,
like he did with
John the Baptist, he did not call him Husur in the Quran because Jesus had these accusations against him. So he's now trying to use the Quran to justify these accusations. If this is accusative answer against the Christians, why is he referencing the Quran, using the example of John the Baptist as someone who's mentioned as a pure person, someone who's faultless, for example, and not Jesus Christ? So he's actually using the Quran to justify his beliefs. So these are very disturbing things he wrote about Jesus Christ. To give you some examples, there is a lot more, Declan. There's a lot. Our scholars, Sunni scholars, okay, have written books on this topic alone, his insults on Jesus Christ in the Urdu language.
I'm glad that you said that the ordinary Ahmadiyya doesn't know this, because, you know, I know one particular Ahmadiyya who said to me, Declan, do you really believe that we would follow somebody? You know, do you believe that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad was the promised Messiah and follow him if he said these horrible things?
There are two options.
They don't know.
There are two options. Either they do know, like the missionaries do, and they basically hide it and don't want to face it.
Because the missionaries do 7 years training or something like that. So they will have to read in full every word that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad.
They are taught about these problems.
They have to be, because they can't complete a sentence without mentioning his name.
Exactly. And they are taught about these problems and how to respond to them. So their training is not about making them scholars of Islam. Their training is about how to defend the cult against attacks.
It's very deceitful.
Yes, 100%. And this is why you don't see scholars among them. They don't produce scholars. And the reason is, Declan, if they produce scholars...
Well, you have to be constantly on your guard, don't you?
Exactly. But look, why do they discourage scholarship? Why do they discourage scholarship? Because they know once their own murabbis start to learn the Arabic language and they indulge deep into the literature of Islam, they will realize how substandard the writings of Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani were. If they started to look into Al-Ghazali, let's say, or Ibn Taymiyyah, or works of Ibn Hajar, and big names, who have Fakhruddin al-Razi, for example, right? These great scholars of Islam, intellectuals and philosophers and thinkers, if these Ahmadi Murabbis or Qadiani Murabbis, if they were to read this literature, they would immediately realize that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani was a charlatan, he was just an imposter, and he was a very substandard writer. A very substandard writer. So coming back to Jesus Christ again, so these are some of the things he said about Jesus Christ, that outrightly insulting him, denying his miracles and insulting him in this language. And he even claimed that Jesus, to defend himself when he abused people in harsh language, using the term bastard child against his opponents. For example, those people who said that he lost the debate against Abdullah Atom, he said, if you think that, then you're a bastard child.
Mm-hmm.
You are a bastard child.
He wasn't a good loser.
Yeah, exactly. He wasn't a good loser. But then when people said, how can you use this language, man? What is wrong with you? How can you use this language and claim to be a prophet? He said, well, Jesus used this language. Jesus used this language against the Pharisees and the Sadducees, so he called them bastard children, but Jesus didn't. He called them the adulterous generation, as if we take the New Testament narrative to be accurate, he called them, according to the New Testament, adulterous generation. That's not quite calling them bastard children, right? He would be calling his own people bastard children if this is what he believed. But Jesus never used this language, okay? His language was so harsh and so abusive that today, when we start to talk about it in front of the Qadianis, they simply don't have the patience to listen to it.
And by the sounds of things, it just wasn't one or two words. It was several passages.
Declan, people have made alphabetical dictionaries of his abusive language. Really?
This is what I need to read.
Okay. I will show you an alphabetical dictionary of his abuse that runs into pages.
When you're doing research like this, Adnan, you know, you get a little piece here, a little piece there.
Yeah.
All the evidence should really be mapped out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you see, the evidence is so much that his 80-odd volumes, or 80-odd books in 22 volumes published as Rouhani Khazain, it is filled with all these things I have mentioned. Okay, so you can do a PhD on Mirza Ghulam Qadiani on one aspect alone. His abuse, you can do a PhD on that. Wow. And I'm not making this up. Okay. I will show you the alphabetical dictionary that some of our activists have created of his abuse, starting from Alif, Ba, Ta, Tha, Urdu alphabets, and the abuse that he has used.
I would really like to see that. Just to finish off this point,
Mary.
Tell me about Mary. Why did he attack Mary? It's one thing attacking Jesus.
In order to cast light on the miraculous birth of Jesus Christ, he had to attack Mary. He had to cast doubts on her character. So he stated many things that are extra-biblical. So this claim that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani was using these ideas or claims to get back at the Christians, or this was accusative answer, doesn't make sense. You know why? Because a lot of the stuff he used against Mary is not biblical, and it's not even extra biblical because we cannot find it anywhere else. For example, he claimed that I read in the books of a Fazil Yahudi, to use the exact term, right? I read in the books or in the works of a Fazil, a learned Jew, who wrote the story about Mary marrying Joseph against the law of Moses. So he accused Mary of living in an illegitimate relationship with Joseph the carpenter. Mm-hmm. So basically, the story goes, which he tells in his works, borrowing from an unknown Jewish source that we cannot find. We have failed to find it. The Qadiani Jamaat cannot produce it. It's been 100 years. They haven't produced that source. They don't know where Mirza got this information from. He claimed that a Fazil Jew, a learned Jew, wrote this. And no one knows who this learned Jew was and where that book is or where that source is. And the story he tells is, and I'm going to summarize it, that Mary, when she got pregnant, when she was pregnant, obviously, questions were raised about her character. To avoid embarrassment, her elders took her to an old man called Joseph the carpenter. So they got her married to Joseph the carpenter against the law of Moses. So Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani uses three terms here to describe this phenomenon. Against the Torah, against the law of Moses, and against the Sharia of Allah. Three terms. Interchangeably. So this was against the Torah, this was against the Mosaic law, and this was against the law of Allah, the law of God. Mm-hmm. So in other words, Mary was forced by her elders into an illegitimate, a prohibited relationship, which amounts to adultery. Right? Which amounts to adultery. Mm-hmm. Clearly, if you're not married and your marriage is not valid, Legally speaking, you are living with a man you're not married to. Yeah. The marriage is not valid. So Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani wrote this, borrowing from an unknown Jewish source that we cannot locate. Okay, and then he endorses it. He endorses the story. He states that this story is valid. And it explains away many difficult things about the life of Mary and her experience with this difficult hour in her life when she was impregnated by a miracle. We believe by a miracle.
Yeah.
So he had to start with Mary, cast doubts on her life and her character in order to transfer that guilt or that character defect into the life of Jesus Christ, and then do all those things we mentioned already. Okay, so Mary basically was attacked for this reason. Okay, and this is not biblical literature. We do not find this in the New Testament. It is not in the apocryphal literature.
And you'd need to see this alleged source to see how valid.
Non-existent. It doesn't exist. It does not exist. And unless Mirza can claim to have had a revelation, the book came from the heavens, and the Jewish rabbi who wrote this book basically never published it, or it never became public. But somehow he found it in India, and I wonder what language he was writing this book in, because it could only be in Persian, Arabic, or Urdu, the languages Mirza knew. He didn't know the English language.
Yeah.
Okay, he had some English revelations that don't make sense as well. Okay, I don't know if you've seen those. So he said a lot more about Mary. For example, he said Mary was a hermaphrodite. He also insinuated that she had male hormones within her body that produced Jesus Christ. Because he rejected the miracle of virgin birth, so he had to come up with some crazy explanation for this. And he claimed that Mary had male characteristics or male hormones, and her own sperm impregnated her. This is what Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani wrote. So Mary was attacked by Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani on so many different accounts. For example, he claimed that Mary was hermaphrodite.
Really?
Right, he did. She was some kind of transvestite / hermaphrodite person, and she had her own sperm, she had male characteristics.
So transgender?
Yes, along those lines. He wrote that, and the reference is on the screen, right? He wrote that she had male characteristics. Her own sperm that was within herself impregnated her, and this is how she became pregnant with Jesus Christ. So this goes against the Quran. This goes against the New Testament.
It's just utterly obscene, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And these are the things the Qadiani Jamaat does not tell the common Ahmadis. They know these things. They know these problems exist. And they are hiding from these problems. They don't respond. They don't give a clear, straightforward response. And they try to play games like, again, whataboutism? What about this person? What about that person? Instead of defending Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani, who was supposed to be a prophet of God, who claimed that Mary was such a person, and categorically states that there was sperm inside her that impregnated her, and this is how she was impregnated. Then we asked them, on a stream, we asked them, can you produce an example from the entire history of humanity or a scientific journal where you can show us someone who is transgender or hermaphrodite or someone who is like a transvestite, someone like that, got pregnant by themselves and gave birth to a child, and they were playing, again, there is no such example.
Wow.
They couldn't produce it. They will do this, they will divert your attention, they will digress from the topic, they will go into another question altogether. But when we ask them specifically to produce an evidence for anyone in human history or a scientific journal that this is even possible, they cannot. So Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani stated something so absurd that it's just not insulting, but outrightly absurd, scientifically speaking. On top of that,
I'm just shocked. I'm actually quite shocked by that last bit.
Yes,
I never ever heard anything.
Well, this is there. It is there. We have discussed it extensively on our streams.
I mean, again, if Christians, if you handed them a book with all of this,
yeah. We have to. I think we have to so that
and say, well, you've got to accept this man as your promised Messiah.
Yeah. Who came for humanity.
Yes,
who came
for all humanity.
Yeah. It doesn't even stop there. I mean, he insulted all other religions. I mean, even Hindus. He called, there was a group of Hindus called the Arya Samaj. He insulted their women because of a tradition they had called Niyog. Niyog, basically in this tradition, when Hindu women could not be impregnated by their husbands, they could choose to have relations with other men by choice, so that they can get pregnant, right? Which is of course not acceptable to most people in the world, right? But this is a tradition they had. But he, using this tradition, he accused the entire community, in particular women, to be prostitutes. He said the women of Arya Samaj are prostitutes. He used this blanket term to describe the women of the entire group called Arya Samaj. In his poetry, he wrote some vulgar poetry on this as well. And again, Declan, the list of absurdities and abuses is so long that we simply do not have the time to address all those things in a short interview like this.
But coming back to Mary,
very quickly, I want to say a few last...
Do please, because there's two questions that I really do want to ask you before we end this interview.
Okay, so Mary, basically, apart from this, he also claimed that she was partly to blame for the accusation against her. An accusation God defends her against in the Quran. Okay? She was accused of unchastity, right? This is very clear in the Jewish literature. In the Talmud, we have references, very unpleasant references to Mary for being possibly an unchaste woman. And God, according to the Quran, God defends her against such accusations categorically. And Allah tells us in the Quran that she was a pure woman. She never committed a sin. Mm-hmm. She was chosen by God to be a pure woman. Yeah. And anyone accusing her is clearly going against the Quran. But Mirza Ghulam Ahmad Qadiani wrote, she was partly to blame for this accusation. Yes, her people accused her. They were to blame for this wrong accusation, but she was also partly to blame for her negligence because she hid this information for far too long from them. His own story is contradictory. His own narrative on Mary alone, put aside Jesus Christ, put aside other people, on Mary alone, his own narrative is highly contradictory and problematic. And the list goes on and on and on. His insults are outright blasphemous, outright insulting and disgusting.
How do you think that people like me, how would you help people like me get to the truth? Because, you know, he wrote all these books, he wrote these 84 books. I've been led to believe that less than 50% of his writings have actually been translated into English. Now, I find it quite extraordinary because the Ahmadiyya community, they have their own publishing house, is Islam International Publications. It's a well-established company. They've published the Quran, let's say, for example, in 75 languages. So, you know, they do disseminate, you know, large volumes of work in different languages. But why in English, the universal language, why not, you know, publish all his works in English? And they have the means to translate.
100%. They had the means almost 100 years ago. In the 1920s, they had the means
But why don't ordinary Ahmadiyyas, and especially the younger generation, why don't they ask these questions?
Because they are specifically and deliberately...
Shielded away from this,
covered. I mean, Mirza's writings, some of those writings are highly problematic. If they were to translate them into the English language, people who were to read them, as the writings of their so-called prophet, they would be highly disturbed. They would be very shocked and disturbed, right? So that's why. Look at Muslims.
But we have to see those. We have to really press for those to be published.
But they're not going to do that because they've had 100 years. They have the money.
Maybe it'll have to be done for them.
Possibly, yes. So if someone wants to do that, it would be a great service to the whole world, for that matter, so that people know what the teachings of this person are, so that the Ahmadis themselves can realize that they have made a mistake. Not they, their ancestors, who didn't know better, who were illiterate peasants.
I was going to ask you that, you know, then in years ago, you know, in Mirza Ghulam Ahmad's lifetime, I mean, what was the literacy rate of Urdu?
Very low.
Was it very low?
Very low.
So who was he writing for?
He was writing for the literati, mainly. And initially, people didn't realize what he was. And as soon as he started to come out with these claims that he is the Mahdi, he is the reviver of the faith, the Mujaddid, then he claimed to be like the Messiah. First, he claimed to be the like the Messiah, Masih, Masih, Masih. Then he claimed to be Masih Ma'ud. the promised Messiah, and then finally he ended up claiming to be a prophet in 1902, right? Just 6 years before he died. So there was a trajectory he was on, and some scholars of Islam had already realized the trajectory he's on, and they had warned the Muslims about his character and how dubious he was. But his immediate followers in his region, in his area, were a bunch of peasants. Majority of the Qadiani followers, common Ahmadis, are descendants of those peasants who were from the Qadian region or neighboring towns and cities.
What would you say the literacy rate is currently amongst the Urdu population?
Not very high in Pakistan and India, not very high, but they are highly educated in the West, naturally, because in the Western world, education is very important. They know they want their children to be educated, but not necessarily educated on the Jamaat and the literature of the Jamaat. Educated in medicine, in engineering, and other things. They are highly intellectual people.
No, I don't dispute that.
But when it comes to the knowledge of their own books, which is in the Urdu language, most of the Western audience is not even able to
read. They're not going to be knowledgeable if it's concealed from them.
Exactly.
Because, you know, as non-Urdu speakers, you know, Western converts and the Africans, we haven't mentioned the African community, well, they're going to be completely in the dark, aren't they, about the writings.
Absolutely. And for the Africans, they have, you see, what they do is Mirza Ghulam al-Qadiani wrote some very simple texts and pamphlets and booklets as well. And they present those to the Africans, and they're filled with spiritual guidance and spiritual instructions. Why wouldn't people find them fascinating and interesting?
Of course.
Because someone talking sensibly about spiritual matters, you won't reject it. But his shenanigans, what I call the shenanigans, and the controversial stuff, and the absurdities and the lies and unfulfilled prophecies.
That was what I was going to ask you. Yeah. There is a cover-up. Do you think that there's a cover-up in having less than 50% of his writings translated into English?
I believe so. I believe some of his writings...
What do you think the community, the Ahmadiyya community, what do you think the response would be to that?
Their response would be no, there's no cover-up, but clearly there is, because you've had 100 years, you have the money, you have the publishing houses, you're printing Qur'ans, you have translated his books.
Muhammad, you're claiming he's the promised Messiah for all humanity, English is the universal language, I want to read all his works.
Yes.
I want to devour them, every single word.
And why wouldn't you do it? Yeah. Why wouldn't you do it? This is why
it's not available to me.
And this is why the majority of their Jamaat is ignorant of Mirza's own writings. And look at the Muslims. We have produced the literature of Islam, all the major works in the English language. We have Sahih al-Bukhari, the prophetic tradition, entirely translated into the English language multiple times. We have Sahih Muslim, entirely in English. We have other 6 books of hadith also in English and Urdu and other languages, right? Why wouldn't you do that with Mirza's books? Why, if he's a prophet of God and you want his works to be out in public and you want people to find that guidance and benefit from it and believe in him,
I find it extraordinary.
Then translate all his works. Why wouldn't they do it?
I know that we're going to run out of time and I'll have to come back a second day because there's just so many more questions that I'm not going to get through. But
one last point I would like to address,
please do.
About his prophecies, so-called prophecies.
Oh yes. If you feel you have time for that, I was going to ask
very quickly. We can mention.
I was going to ask you because this really only came to my attention after I had completed the book on the Lahori Ahmadiyya movement. Because you know, I went through his revelations, and I tried my best to put it into an interesting narrative. I did struggle, and the Lahoris struggled as well to get me sources in English about his revelations. That was a bit of a struggle, that part of the research. But one of the stories that wasn't given to me, and I have since learned that it's very controversial. And that's the story of Miss Begum.
Yeah, Muhammadi Begum.
Yeah.
A very famous case.
Could you, if you've got time, because
there
might be many, many people that have never heard this.
We have done extensive streams.
Okay.
We have done extensive streams on this topic alone. Anyone who wants to see the details, go to my YouTube channel, Adnan Rashid, and check out our streams.
But why is this particular?
Yeah, this particular...
Revelation.
Prophecy was very interesting for many reasons. First of all, Mirza wanted to marry this young man when he was already quite old, well into his 50s, right? And he wanted to get married to this young woman.
How old was she?
She was a young 11 or 12.
She was a distant, from my she research, she was a distant relative.
That's right.
Her father was a distant relative.
Yes, and she was more closely related to his son's wife, Mirza Ghulam Qadiani's son's wife. And her father came to Mirza for some help and support in some land dispute. And Mirza, in return, asked for him to give his daughter in marriage to him. And then he made up a prophecy that God has already prophesied that this marriage will take place.
And how old was Mirza Ghulam Ahmad?
In his 50s. He was already in his 50s.
So from my research, I believe he got married for a second time.
Yeah.
I think he was 49.
Okay.
He was 49.
Yeah.
Because he got married, first marriage was...
With Sultan Jahan Begum, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is his second wife, his gave him most of his children. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They had 10 children.
Yeah. She was from Delhi. She was from Delhi.
Well, right? When I said they had 10 children, I do believe that five died at birth. Or
in
early
collectively,
infancy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. This is a separate issue. With Muhammadi Begum, he wanted to marry her by hook or by crook. First of all, he expressed his desire, which was refused outrightly, flatly.
But he was already married at this time.
He was already married. He was already married. He was in his 50s already.
And having children with his wife.
Yeah. And he was extremely ill. He had many illnesses, including diabetes and melancholy and other conditions. He himself describes he would go to the toilet 100 times a day, according to his own confession. Yes, 100 times a day.
He wrote about this.
Mm-hmm. And he even claimed this to be a miracle. He said, the prophecy about Jesus coming back with two pieces of cloth from the heavens, like Prophet Muhammad prophesied that Jesus will come back in Damascus with two angels. He will descend physically himself and he will be dressed in two pieces of cloth. Okay, he said those two pieces of cloth actually represent two defects I have. One is the headaches, which is the top cloth that covers the top, and the bottom cloth that covers his lower part of the body is basically my excessive urination and defecation and spending time in the toilet. He said, you seem to be shocked. You're shocked, you're surprised.
I'm shocked.
But he actually had the audacity to claim this. And it is surprising that decent people, working class people, doctors and engineers, they believe this man to be a prophet of God. He claimed that prophecy for himself, and his defects, medical defects, he used them to be a miracle of God. A sign from God, for that matter.
So during his 50s, he had remarried for a second time, having all these children, obviously not very well. And he was still obsessed with this woman.
Until the day he died.
Why did he think that God wanted him to marry Miss Begum?
If God wanted him to marry this woman or this girl, it would have happened.
He would have arranged it.
It would have happened. It would have transpired. It never transpired.
Why was he obsessed with this woman?
He felt that he wants to marry a young woman, clearly, because this happened when her father...
An old man's love. Possibly. Well, that's what Anthony Trollope would...
It's anyone's guess. Okay. So but the way he went about it, was very indecent. Okay. For example, he published pamphlets and advertisements on her. Okay. Mentioning her name publicly. Dragging her name publicly. That this woman will be married to me. This is an unchanging destiny from God. This destiny cannot change. It cannot be averted. It can be delayed, but it will never be averted. She will marry me before I die. And he kept saying this until the day he died. Days before he died, he had mentioned this, that it will be fulfilled.
And he died in Lahore, didn't he?
He died in Lahore, and it never happened. It never happened. And the worst part, Declan, is that he said it is unchanging destiny. Taqdeer-e-mubram. This is the word he used. This is the term he used. That it cannot be averted. It will happen. And you know how he went about trying to do it? He blackmailed people. He blackmailed his own son. He told his son that if your wife does not talk to her family to convince them to give this girl to me in marriage, she will be divorced. And he forced his son to divorce her. He forced his son, and his son was refusing to divorce her. This actually occurred. So he was trying to make this marriage happen by hook or by crook. Not that God had anything to do with it. He wanted to do it, but he put it all on God. And it doesn't stop there, Declan. This is one example. And many people, by the way, left him, so, as they say, apostatized from his cult and religion, came back to mainstream Islam after they saw what happened, right? Because of his behavior towards this girl, this innocent young girl, and how it wasn't fulfilled, his so-called prophecy. Also, there are other things he mentioned. For example, he said that God has extended his life to a certain period, and God has told me specifically that he will live longer than 14 months from July 1907. This was against one of his opponents who had prophesied similarly to him that he will die within the next 14 months. Mirza responded in July 1907 saying, God has told me directly that I will outlive 14 months from July 1907. He dies in May 1908, 26th of May 1908. He dies within 9 months. So clearly God didn't know what he was talking about. God, I mean, they come back and say, no, this happened because the man who challenged him changed his mind, Abdul Hakim Patialvi. He changed his mind. But my question is, did God know that Abdul Hakim Patialvi will change his mind? And if he knew, why did God tell Mirza that he will outlive 14 months from July 1907? This is God playing games, God not knowing what he's doing. God is not organized.
But Miss Begum's husband lived, didn't he? He didn't die.
He was also prophesied
to die.
Basically, Mirza Ghulam Al Qadiani said, if she is married to someone else, Muhammad Begum, then her father will die and her husband will die.
So, for argument's sake, if this young woman, if her husband did die...
He didn't die.
He didn't die, but no. If he did die, he was going to marry her. So what was he going to do with his wife and children?
He was still waiting for her to be married to him. He was waiting for him to die.
But what would he have done with his wife? His own wife. Because at this stage he'd been married.
Look,
having all these children, ten children, 1 year.
To his own children. You mean Mirza's own children?
His own children.
He was a prophet of God. He was a promised Messiah. He could have had many wives. So the issue was how he went about it. So first, the prophecy, half the prophecy was fulfilled because her father died within that time. But her husband, Sultan Beg, lived for another 40 years. And Mirza prophesied that he will also die within 3 years.
Yeah.
He didn't die. And when people went back to him, asking him, okay, the father died within the time, because he was an old man, he was already dying. Okay, it's only common sense that he will die soon, because he was already elderly and he was quite ill. But this guy, who was a young man, why didn't he die? Mirza said, well, he changed his mind, he repented.
Repented for what?
Exactly. Repented for what? If he repented, in that case, he should have divorced Muhammadi Begum so that Mirza's prophecy can be fulfilled. He never divorced her. He had children with her. And they both died disbelieving in Mirza. Muhammadi Begum and Sultan Beg died Muslims. They didn't believe in Mirza Ghulam Qadiani. Okay? So, to summarize, these are only two examples I gave you, his failed prophecies. There's a long list of these failed prophecies that we have discussed. For example, Abdullah Atom, the man he debated, the Christian missionary. He stated that he will die on a certain date. He didn't die. He outlived that date by many months, actually 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. And on that day, when he was supposed to die, in Qadian, people were basically doing religious, spiritual gatherings and praying for his death. And Mirza actually did some ritual. He took some chickpeas and blew on them something, and he threw them in a well. And he said, don't look back. And this was to kill him. This was to kill Abdullah Atom. Maybe it was a magical ritual or maybe some kind of spiritual shenanigans he tried to do to Abdullah Atom. Abdullah Atom outlived the problem. And many people, actually, his opponents celebrated. And again, many people apostatized. So if Mirza was a true prophet of God, a lot of these prophecies would have been fulfilled. And he would have had a lot more followers today.
Just to finish off on the story of Miss Begum, what is the response of the Ahmadiyya community for this?
There's no... I mean, when we asked them, if this was unchanging destiny and it never happened, why did Mirza not get married to her? They say, oh, the marriage took place spiritually in the heavens. So this was again metaphorical spin. This was a metaphorical marriage that happened with God inside of God. They were both married spiritually. Okay, that's one response. The other response is that, oh, you know, it didn't happen because God changed his mind. Simply, God changed his mind. Okay, so there are many responses they give to this.
Yeah.
Okay, and they come back with many complicated arguments. They try to complicate things. Oh, look at this aspect. Look at that aspect. Look at this angle. Look at that angle. To basically build a narrative to convince people that it wasn't that bad. But actually, Mirza, when he said it's unchanging destiny, the essence of the prophecy is. The essence of the prophecy is unchanging destiny. And what was the essence of the prophecy? I will marry Muhammadi Begum. Full stop.
And it never happened.
And
he didn't marry.
It didn't happen. Yeah.
And then we've got to leave it at that for today. There's still lots of questions I've been unable to ask you. Time has run out.
We can do it again.
I will have to come back a second time. But for today, thank you very much indeed.
You're most
welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.